Iambic Audiobooks presents Sentimental Exorcisms by David Derry, read by Anthony St. Pierre. Just Watch, an Apologia. It was the simple logic of two premises and their inevitable conclusion that ultimately led me to become a voyeur. First, a few feeble acts of missionary sex with my cooperative former girlfriend had numbed me to those pleasures. A1 becomes B, as in boring. Escorting her to the door, I reflected on the nature of desire, on all the trifles already discarded by my sensuous and sentimental appetites. Other A's had become B. My conclusion, if predictable, was persuasive. Attainment is annihilation. Is liberation. All A's become B. Rhomboid ruby, pubic crown, that word-bearing wispy crux of a girl. I shut the door behind her, picked up the picture of Dorian Gray, and read. 5 or 6 monastic weeks passed, me burning the midnight oil. As one of the University of Toronto's top English undergrads living on my own, I was free as an eagle and happy as a lark. I wrote a first-rate essay about Wilde's influence on English modernism, listened to Schubert, dreamed in heroic terms. Meanwhile, my spurned libido. Like the turgid buds loosening in the kind spring sun, dropping pollen on the lawn, it grew, a glance at a time, out from the shadows, as exclusively orificial in its aims as ever, and demanding enactment, yes. But, like the writer who requires mere crumbs of the outer realm to feed his creation, I no longer wished to participate. Oh, my dear girls, you deceptively simple compositions.
One stands on the corner shouldering an attaché case, and by accident exposes her scarlet bra strap. Another makes sure nobody's looking before she bends like a beast for a box of condoms on the bottom shelf.
I could go on ad nauseam, listing contradictory attitudes, on and on about feminine wiles and their cracks, invaded by jeans that are far too tight, or by a sweaty pair of spandex short shorts. Things came to a head in July. A mass of hot American air slammed Toronto on the first of the month, stinking of brewer's yeast and lake sewage, and the streets thronged with thousands of practically naked girls. I bolted myself inside my apartment, tried to keep at my studies like a good, responsible son, but the mere click of a female's footfalls past my gaping window, and I'd be done for. A wreck, slumped across my desk with no place to go. A week of air quality advisories came and went. My books abandoned, I prowled the city in a maze of longing, ratiocination, and untested hypotheses. Finally, Saturday morning, lying tangled in my sheet, I deemed my logic sound, i.e., satisfaction effects elimination. So to root out my one irregular vein of sexuality, I simply had to indulge it. And if my plan of action did not exactly qualify as an uncompromising categorical imperative, nor was it simply me mindlessly succumbing to my urges. For the sake of my studies, for my expectant parents who had invested so much in my nebulous future, for the anonymous wife at the center of that distant nebula, I had to get on with it, to slake my impossible thirst before the thing got away on me and my light summer course load. You must understand, there are few more upstanding than me. It's my conviction that both rapists and wife-beaters should be castrated as a matter of course, for I believe in the larger good, the big picture, the need for pragmatic action. Minimize harm, my dad would say. But as so often happens with situational ethics, I was caught on the horns of a dilemma. I hesitated before the ladders, stacked in front of the hardware store, and considered the harm that either action or inaction might entail. By proceeding, I'd clearly be committing deliberate, if hands-off, incursions into people's sacred privacy. But if they didn't realize, was harm done? On the other hand, indefinitely suppressing my desire as best I could, praying that my academic standing wouldn't sink along with my parents' pride, seemed a risky bet. Of course, the possibility of being caught red-handed had to be factored into the equation, but so did the common knowledge that an initially quite innocent, frustrated desire is often the seed of more sinister tendencies.
I weighed a 16-foot aluminum ladder and decided it was right.
The cashier, a kitteny teen, managed to evade my smiles. Then her nipples responded instantly to the one downward glance of my flashing gaze. I pictured those nipples all the way home, hard like my resolve, but with an overdue paper on psychosexual symbolism and the turn of the screw suddenly heavy on my mind, there wasn't time to daydream. I muffled the tops of the ladder rails with old socks and duct tape, stashed the thing in a dilapidated garage behind the building, and raced inside for a shower before putting my nose to the grindstone. Admittedly, certain windows had already caught my passive eye on my way home from the library late at night, or returning from my friends, whom I'll call Albert. Once I glimpsed what looked to be flesh, but despite backtracking and slowly passing a second time, I couldn't ascertain whether it actually was an object of delight. I began taking evening strolls, following alleys behind houses and the peripheries of parks. Such activities sound suspect, certainly, but from my perspective, they remained well outside the bounds of voyeurism proper. That Saturday evening, I was completely out of sorts. I phoned Albert,
whom I've known since boarding school,
but hung up after three rings and angrily searched the freezer for a bite to eat. Cursing, I tried him again, this time letting him answer. Finding his voice tedious and slightly enraging, I barked that I was far too busy to play chess, and ordered myself a pizza instead. The vapid television. Gorging on Hawaiian deep dish, I scanned my umpteen channels over and over until 10:29 on the DVD clock finally became 10:30. Off with my gym shorts, on with crisp new jeans and a long-sleeved shirt, both black. I looked foolish, somewhere between a friendless wannabe rocker and an unconvincing artiste. Nothing like the upright fellow in white or tan khakis and a collared blue shirt I normally present. But the white painter's coveralls. Another life, I painted houses the summer between high school and university with Albert, who by rights should come clean about those filched undies he probably still keeps in a shoebox under his bed. That I pulled over top seemed a bit more a part of me and certainly gave the right impression. I turned off all the lights and left. It so happened I'd become aware of the habits of several local households. A young couple, for instance, lived in a house that backed onto the alley behind my building. He was a typical male, egotistical, bent on pornography and computer games, essentially a cipher, while she had a compact, underappreciated little body on her. They usually made for the bedroom shortly after 11. But that night, their house was dark as an unburgled tomb. Helpless as a child, I stood staring at the windows opaquely reflecting the city's jaundiced light. My second prospect was only four backyards away and housed a large, cumbersome family. Three kids,
a husband, and a wife.
She was the one I'd seen out walking, long skirts billowing like curtains, and I happily recall her struggle as a pursuant wind kept at her substantial, round behind. A television flickered downstairs. Above, a half-drawn blind winked a heavy lid over the lighted bedroom window. Setting down the ladder, I penetrated a low border hedge and stole across the lawn to peer breathlessly inside. Children on the floor, under a blanket, engrossed in the screen. Good enough. I stripped down to black and angled my ladder next to a fir tree. I started to climb with tentative steps, almost afraid a rung might snap. But those aluminum ladders, with each step they flex to thrust their climber after grand ideas. I stopped just below the windowsill, knees bent. Blood drummed in my ears, my hands and feet were numb. But nothing could be done for that. I simply tapped the same intrepid resolve with which I used to dive straight into icy water at good old Camp Comanche, and straightened my legs. Bathos, Greek, for depth. A shallow-bottomed lake. I banged my figurative head against the following scene. A television at the foot of the bed showed the throes of some bloody chaos. Immediately below me lay the flaxen head of my curvaceous doll, sleeping, and the torpid husband beside her was about to lose the glasses off the tip of his whistling schnoz. This signally bleak tableau vivant was crowned by a fat brown beagle of the smelliest sort I could imagine, laid out between them and gnawing the remote. I wanted to smash the glass and tear off their sheets. Stifling a scream, I descended the ladder as swiftly as quietly possible and beat a fast retreat across the yard. My only remaining hope lay with the evening's last possibility, an essie, svelte black girl. Tall and lean, she'd kick when she walked, reminding me of a wishbone. I don't remember the short dash to her house, only crossing an empty lot, reassured by the protection it afforded. A room downstairs was bright. There, she sat watching TV alone. In the window above, an air conditioner hummed and ticked. I set my ladder beside it, and, tucking myself under a lilac, was surprisingly content to lie embowered by the protective bed of night, with a sporadic breeze soughing overhead. When the downstairs light went out, I scrambled up to the second highest rung, not generally a safe place to stand. But to keep from being seen, I'd have to watch downward through the top pane. She entered, a faint halo caught in her loose evening afro, before I'd even had a chance to adjust myself properly, and was tugging off her clothes, tossing them in the corner as she made a beeline for the bed. To masturbate, I grinningly surmised, forcing me to dodge from sight before the essentials were off. But I cautiously espied her dark arm peeling back the bedspread, a tantalizing prologue, followed at once by a flash of the novel piece that her fine black body was, all that for so long had insinuated itself into my heart from under tight hobble skirts. She switched off the light. I kissed the cold bricks and raced home to flip through some magazines before retiring as well. One tiny blue tablet, a draught of water, a heavy, satisfied sleep. A month of twice-weekly expeditions ensued. Mondays and Thursdays were my nights of action. Steadfast abstinence at all other times ensured I went unnoticed and afforded me a sense of self-restraint. My spare hours I spent artistically detailing a map of the neighborhood, soon to cover an entire bedroom wall, and also monkeying around with a branching agenda. My first conclusion? Most people's lives are boring. A couple of unusual encounters aside, I'm not exaggerating in saying that three-quarters of the couples I tracked led unremarkable, virtually non-existent, sex lives. I blame the flaccid husbands. True, women reach their prime long after men are spent, but even the youngest bucks behaved like neuters. I quickly learned that if I was to have any hope of vanquishing my overweening desire, I'd need to expand my territory. In accordance with the first rule of strategic planning, I took to my desk and prioritized. Intellectual honesty was indispensable, as well as a willingness to sacrifice certain secondary attractions. After much typing and deleting, probing myself from every angle, I cleared the screen and with deliberate keystrokes distilled the spirit of my lust into three main objectives. 1. Observation of lesbians. 2. Observation of a Chinese girl fornicating. 3. Observation of a woman being sodomized. It seemed to me that by witnessing these scenarios, I'd exhaust my spectator's desire and, sated, bored, and happy, could revert to an orthodox lifestyle. It's incredible what one can accomplish if one puts one's mind to it. My parents used to tell me that, but I never gave it much thought. Objectives 1 and 2 were notched in my belt, so to speak, within a month of conception. Just as my parents counseled, it took patience, discipline,
and an open mind.
First, I dropped my summer courses. That a couple of poor grades should tarnish my transcript, perhaps preventing me from graduating with distinction, all because of a fleeting distraction, was absurd. Better to concentrate on the task at hand and re-enroll in September, refreshed for my final year. Thus relieved of obligations, I deepened my commitment, exploring promising neighborhoods during the day, Chinatown, the University District, Gaytown, and returning at night to climb and shimmy, quick with great expectations.
I witnessed a lot that harried month,
acts that surprised and disgusted me. But I'm not writing pornography, so only two notes are germane to the present discussion. One, I did taste success, 66.6% to be exact, inadequate, but sufficient to prove my father's sententious counsel sound. Accomplishment is a triune consummation of vision, imagination, and application. An aphorism he'd pen inside the cover of my daily planner at the beginning of each new school year. Two, objective three was the 33.3% I sorely missed. The male body is repulsive. It serves the crude, if necessary, role of penetrator, in itself best ignored. No, my drive to Sodom was not by the high road of homoerotic transposition. I simply asterisked the act for its guttural moan. In the fourth month of that four-month relationship with my former girlfriend, one attempt at sodomy had transpired. I'd been feeling tongue-tied, disinclined to discuss things. Eventually, she wheedled it out of me, smiled and said, "Why not?" She knelt on the bed. I nudged in behind her, then balked, just an inch from that fetid hole. How stupid we looked, hunched like that. My affection for her vanished, like a wisely deleted simile, but the asterisk of the act would soon wink again in the heavens of my mind. Objective three was to be the acme and the omega of my illicit pursuits. A methodical approach seemed impossible. How to recognize a female sodomite? I wasted 3 weeks on random chance, hitting downtown neighborhoods without the ladder, stooping to have a look through edges of imperfectly blinded basement windows. My initial groundless optimism quickly succumbed to rage and despair. One night, walking up Young Street, yet again I was questioning whether my plan was realistic. Already it was the end of August, a Sunday, very late, and a diffuse flow of traffic was moving north. I'd gotten stuck leapfrogging with a crew of garbage collectors who kept squealing to a stop immediately in front of me,
shooting bags into the back end of their dripping truck,
and then roaring forth to stop ahead of me again. In the middle of navigating one especially fouled section of pavement, I was startled by a dainty hand brandishing a whip. Whap! Whap! I froze, credulous from exhaustion. No, just a storefront dummy. Delectably attired, but utterly inert. Still, I kept staring, pondering the curve of her buttocks, the cleft in her groin, reluctant to go trudging off home with nothing to show for my effort. But hold on. A sex shop. Why hadn't I thought of that? Lorraine's Palace, read the extinguished neon sign, in cursive script, punctuated with an exclamatory cat-o'-nine-tails. I chuckled, sort of to the mannequin, sort of to myself, until my reflection caught my eye. No matter, I knew where I was and would be back. A bounce to my step, I marched home and popped 3 sleeping pills for good measure. It's important to remember I was harming no one. On the spectrum of illicit activities, mine falls at the fringe, in the light gray zone where social impropriety gets called criminal. The crimes that are black, the truly vicious acts, have consequences so immediate they offer no real temptation to the man with a conscience. But nobody was harmed by my behavior. I repeat, no one was really affected. Of what am I to repent, then? To whom do I address this defense of my struggle for self-improvement? Soon, I was a regular. Larry, the polite Chinese man who owned the place, would smile and nod discreetly when I entered. This quiet familiarity was reassuring, if a little embarrassing. Incidentally, Larry was heavy and poorly groomed. I can still see him stuffed behind the counter in a sweatsuit, lifting gleaming noodles to his mouth, immured in unshelved stock. In my hand I have a video, Lucy's Hunger. Larry sets down his dinner box and chopsticks and, unmoved by gaping Lucy, checks the price.
$24.90.
He slips the video into a brown paper bag and,
"Thank you,"
hands it back with a complacent nod. That's how I remember him, and each time I do, his hair and the noodles gleam a bit more brilliantly, and the number of dildos peering out from half-unpacked boxes seems to grow. Of course, a video can come in handy. Or magazines. The dildo and Benoit balls were a waste of money. I told taciturn Larry they were for my girlfriend. But being a regular, paying customer made it possible for me to snoop. Too bad the clientele was mostly male. The races were all present. The classes fairly counted. Now and then a pair of jocular fags slipped in, or snickering adolescents had to be chased out, but most of us entered alone, browsed alone, and eventually exited nervously. The rare girl that did appear was always armed with a circumspect meathead. What kept me faithful to Larry? One, my superstition that an invisible hand was behind the one with the whip, and more importantly, two, mother's trenchant advice. Patience is the ingredient missing from unrealized dreams. Choose your noble path and see it through. This compliment to my father's maxim consoled me through fruitless, thrice-weekly snoops. From the moment of arriving, I'd want out. But when my 90 minutes were up, I wouldn't want to leave. What else was there to do? I had postponed re-enrolling in school. Still, I exercised restraint, determined not to lose sight of myself, and also concerned with appearances. 2 weeks into this new routine, fractured dreams started breaking into the hitherto impenetrable darkness of my pharmaceutical sleeps. I dreamed of myself as a child, so it seemed. But I was an adult, I think, feeling around for a crack in the boarding school wall that I used for hiding recreational drugs from the housemasters. Somehow, I accidentally took some LSD in the car on my way home with my parents. The bare-branched trees were flashing past, my parents' eyes sharply lashing, and I got mired in such viscous space that I couldn't even roll down the window. I awoke to the growing conviction that my real life was being lived in a most occluded place. There's a sense of right and wrong behind even our most wanton behavior, especially our most wanton behavior. I report this not because I was assailed by shame, although sometimes I was, it is true, particularly when noon hour's vacuous light struck my dreadful dreams flat across the pavement of another afternoon, but because my ongoing reading and reflection has shown me some interesting correspondences between my erotic objectives and the Victorian mores I descend from. For instance, in Confessions of a White Slaver by the reformed Peregrine Samuels, circa 1897, we read, "Oriental concupiscence, incurable in the yellow races, is aggravated by the widespread use of opium by Chinese of both sexes, whereby some of the blame lies at the feet of our unscrupulous Foreign Office." Another rare find. The once illicit Physiology of Unnatural Acts, 1882, which devotes entire, tastefully illustrated, chapters to both the Gomorrah maidservant and unnatural intercourse among the French. Like subliminal messages in TV commercials, my forefathers' moralistic prurience had been transmitted to me. Back to Larry's, and the final stage in this quest for resolution. On Friday of the 4th week of September, a peroxide blonde entered on stiletto heels, sporting leather pants and a cropped black top. She came with a greasy man. Around her eyes and corrugating her upper lip, lines betrayed an aging contradicted by an apparent firmness of rump. The pair surveyed a rack of sex toys, cackling conspiratorially about this one and that, and I thought of her leathers as skin, as the rind around a somewhat desiccated orange that, with effort, one might still manage to peel. Suddenly, and with a very casual attitude, she took down a thick pink butt plug and snickered. They passed it back and forth until eventually she did put it back, but almost reluctantly, certainly slowly enough for it to be inferred that she was not averse to the business for which it had been manufactured. I waited for them to leave. Now. I thrust several magazines at Larry, saying I'd be back, and rushed out the door. North. I was with them in seconds, and, reassured, drifted back a bit in the early evening crowd. As we walked, I wondered, will they drive? I was alert for cabs. What if they go to a movie? Or a strip club? Should I enter? Or wait outside? What about a bar? We descended into the subway, and, on a train north, positioned ourselves at opposite ends of the same car, which was packed and stunk of human. I couldn't see her, but he was tall enough for me to keep tabs on his thin, dancing ponytail until it swished and slunk toward the door when we clattered into Bloor Station. I followed suit. We descended further underground and caught an eastbound train, full like the other. Half the passengers disembarked at Broadview. He took a seat beside her, right close together, her leather juncture, his hairy hand fumbling, straying. Damn it, what's hidden before our eyes? The train screamed into Coxwell, and we all leaned as one against the braking speed, then popped direct. Above ground it was already getting dusky. Although we'd been sweating out an Indian summer, the air smelt like fall, and I distinctly remember having to banish from my mind my mother's wistful pronouncement of the season's end.
So short the summer of life.
2 blocks west on Danforth, they turned into a doorway beside a picture frame shop in a 2-story brick affair, an arrangement common in that part of the city. Stores below, apartments on top, backed by a laneway. I zipped down the driveway to the back and, concealing myself beneath a crabapple heavy with overripe fruit, focused on the upstairs windows. First, a light toward the front. The hall. Next, a small frosted window implied a bathroom. Was she urinating? No, there she was in the kitchen, pulling out some pots, beyond a sliding glass door that opened onto a deck and fire escape. Behind her passed the man to a room out front. A room, it occurred to me, that could only face the street. The bedroom. No other window faced the back. The bedroom faced the street. Stumbling into the darkening driveway that led to Danforth, I propped my crestfallen person against a wall, sickened by the thought that there was no end in sight, when a splash of weak light appeared on the pavement before me. Oh, benevolent spirits! Mine slipped from its chains of despair to flit and flicker far past a small second-story window directly above me, and commune with the minions of high hope that dwell in a darkening firmament. I had no doubts about that lighted square, like Pascal and his bush. Granted, circumstances were treacherous. I'd have to use my ladder. There'd be passers-by in the street. A car could wheel in at any moment. But desperation and an inordinate capacity for misplaced optimism allow us to rationalize possibilities that prudence should preclude. The driveway would soon be dark. I could lean my ladder almost parallel to the wall. People avoid alleys at night. Back to the crabapple.
She was chopping a cabbage.
Several tins sat open on the counter. I ran out to the street and flagged a cab. Already half changed into my blacks and whites, I phoned Albert to borrow his car, explaining that a friend he'd never met was moving to town and I'd agreed to help paint his apartment. He sounded annoyed, interrogated me about this new friend of mine and about what I'd been up to, but he did consent. 20 minutes later, I strapped my ladder to his station wagon, with a promise that I'd play chess soon. It was good and dark. The radio was tuned to some kind of electronica, as if I wasn't charged up enough already. But its relentless beat did nicely underlie my determination, drove me fast past female freshmen on Bloor, over the bridge, and the valley below. In the theater of my mind,
a single loop of hope. The coveted moment of penetration.
I parked a safe distance from the scene of the crime, on a street east of Coxville, and, in an effort to seem harmless, loosened my gait and relaxed my mouth, hurrying through the back streets, emerging onto Danforth only 50 meters from my dangerous point of access. At the driveway, I betrayed no hesitation, just turned in, and the anxiety that in truth had been threatening to fell me noticeably diminished at the sight of a luminous slit between drawn curtains in the window upstairs. I ran to the comforting tree. Kitchen light? On. Hallway and bathroom? Both dark. Nobody in sight. No time to lose. I stripped off my coveralls and stuffed them in the crook of a branch. A raucous clutch of teens lurched past the end of the driveway. Would they have noticed, I soberly asked myself, had I been in place? Drunkenness of the citizenry got added to the list of propitious conditions that had convinced me of my plan's infallibility. I took my ladder and set it at a steep angle, without so much as a tap. I have no idea whether anyone passed while I was at work. With my footing secure, the job was done. All I could do was climb. One rung at a time. Don't rush. Descending is more treacherous than ascending. I always felt stronger the further I pulled from the ground. In my mind's eye, my face is right next to a window with burgundy curtains and a crack where they meet. One hand grips a rung, the other's on the sill, and I tingle like I'm conducting a weak electric charge. In there I hear it, that pained mantra of lust, but can't see. I shift a little more. Still nothing but whimpers and groans. Never mind. Try to enjoy. I go a rung higher.
There. There, I hear her. The frantic animal attempting its escape. Damn it. I need to see.
What are you doing?
I froze.
Bitch.
I couldn't see.
Something crashed.
Get back over here, you little bitch.
A shriek was clapped right off.
Over here!
Grunt.
Now her.
Get off! No! Stop it! Stop! Bang! Bang! Shots? Jesus, Van, change the channel, huh? And open the curtains while you're at it. It's scorching in here.
When you set your ladder steep, like I did, every move must oppose a potential topple. One lurching step down, that's it, and every bloody organ knew that I'd forgotten. My clutching form traced an arc across the driveway and crashed against the opposite wall. I was dangling from a shuddering rung.
What the fuck?
The sum of his irate response. Hand over hand, I started to descend the ladder.
Angie, call the cops!
I released my grip. Pulling myself together, heading for the street. But I stopped, fearing witnesses, and ran for the back. That was my mistake, the flip of the coin that I regret to this day. For as I rounded the building, my would-be captor came booming down the fire escape like a runaway orangutan and tackled me. I landed and curled, anticipating blows, but there came only hot breath in my ear.
What the fuck? What the fuck?
We waited in the dirt. Without another word. The cops arrived with their invasive lights and noise. I was cuffed and pulled upright.
Mr. Barrett, they said. Mr. Barrett.
they pushed my wallet back into my pants. Aggravating my misery, the sounds I'd taken to be wind-stirred leaves while down on the ground were in fact the whispers of two or three clusters of onlookers who hung back and stared. Besides the policeman's grip steering me by the arm to one of the cruisers, a distinct sensation of thumbs stays with me, being pressed down by thumbs. The shake of a bathrobed grandmother's puffy head, the policeman's unrelenting, mechanical use of my surname from handcuffing to fingerprinting, despite the harmless nature of a transgression that still feels more on the order of a finger caught in the cookie dough than a bona fide crime. My careful logic is dismissed out of hand. Justifications prompt cries from my mother, and Dad's angry fist planted on the kitchen counter. Only my magnanimous lawyer treats me like myself, although he maintains the futility of this defense and keeps reiterating the practical need for me to repent. Van struck me to the ground. The jig was up. A cop pressed on my head to get me into the car, like he was recorking a bottle of wine. Someone in the crowd yelled, "Pervert!" Society in action. Was it worth it? The question is unanswerable, as in any failed endeavor. True, I've lost everything I was trying to save with my bold maneuvering. I'm living with my parents, whose pride in me is gone, and I'm temporarily suspended from the department. My hypothesis has been neither proven nor irrefutably disproved. My hunger's not quite sated. But when it seems in life that you have a fighting chance of conquering some problematic aspect of yourself, if you don't take it, you end up with not only the original problem, still compounding, but also with regret. It's enough to make an effort. I believe that. To give it your all and walk away a loser. Driving home from the police station with the windows shut tight, my parents wouldn't stop eyeing me in the rearview mirror until my mother, unable to contain herself a moment longer, twisted around and asked in her anguished tone, "What are we without our morals?" Can you understand my answer? That there's no way to know?